Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizban, and I'm joined today by Nico Sarian, Zohar Atkins, and Genevieve Kim. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Hey. All right. So, the quote we are running this week is by Thales of Miletus, cited by Aristotle. And he says, all things are full of gods. All things are full of gods. What? Zohar or Nico or Genevieve, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes.
Yes.
As a Christian. I have a question.
Yeah.
What is a god?
Yeah. What is a god? What is a god to an ancient Greek like Thales?
Yeah, we can unpack the quote, but yeah, this is going to take me like 10 minutes to go at this. And it's nice because it might be useful because there was a clip that went around that you edited of me talking about the ego, remember? Mm-hmm. And the drives and the multiplicity. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to invoke a quote by Carl Jung, but an idea that Jung had to talk about this quote, which is that the deities or the gods today survive in the unconscious. And what does this mean? No? And so imagine Achilles, no? Back mm-hmm. 2000, whatever, 3000 years ago, or whatever, being suffering or going through a spur of rage, no? In war. And I guess like a modern subject individual, when experiencing rage, no, or any emotion, but let's stick with rage here, would, in a sense, understand that the rage is originary from oneself, no? The idea that you're the one who's the source of the rage, that the mm-hmm. rage is arising from within. And this can take me some time to explain, but we could talk about it throughout. The Greeks did not understand emotion as, and I'm like gambling here, but bear with me, as something that is inherent within the self. It's something that is of which the self is receptive, and that which didn't have a conception of the self as we have, but the self there is being receptive of something that is, in a sense, foreign to itself.
So you're saying they're being possessed.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It's the ancient, what the Greeks called the mania, no? The ancient form of possession. And I have a book here, which I happen to have it here, but nonetheless, it speaks to all of this. It's by a psychologist called Julian Jaynes. It's not very well known, but it's a crazy book. It's called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. Have you guys, maybe Zohar? No? It's not very well known. Basically, the idea that he says is that the Greeks had a bicameral mind for which one side was, in a sense, the screen or the support, which is a Latin term. But what I mean, there is something that is superimposed onto something else. One was having a fit of rage. It wasn't that one was wrathful or angry or violent or aggressive. It was that there was a god that was possessing one's own superimposed, possessed. And what's very interesting about this, and this is something that James talks about, is that what we understand by schizophrenia today, or by a schizoid mind, is more of a vestige of the bicameral mind of the Greeks, by which mm-hmm. something that is happening to you is seen as totally foreign, in almost an objective way. So to go back to
what motivates the gods to take possession of mortals, and if we're going to personify them and think of them as also having emotions, then mm-hmm. do the gods have bicameral minds and then they're also possessed? So you follow it all the way back, and then what is the beginning of it all?
Right.
So then this is, you know, Aristotle came up with the concept of the prime mover, who in contrast, let's say, to the more Homeric conception of the gods as emotional, is this kind of self-contemplative entity. But how does anger then arise, or how does desire then arise in this conception of these emotions as almost having autonomy or semi-autonomy?
Right.
It seems like they have to come from somewhere.
That's where it goes. That's your progression, because you start out with, I don't know where you start out with, but let's say that you have polytheism. Now you have a variety of gods that represent different drives. And then someone like Zohar comes around and says, well, where is all of this coming from?
the origin? Yeah. That's the story of Abraham, according to the Jewish interpretation, is he in the Midrash, which is the rabbinic commentary on the Torah. So Abraham's father, Terach, was an idol maker. Quite an ironic backstory, right, for the father of monotheism. His father made a living selling idols. So this is a story that every religious Jewish kid learns growing up. Abraham destroys his father's idols. He just, one day his father goes away and he just takes a bludgeon and he just starts destroying all these idols. His father comes back. My shop has been vandalized. What have you done? And Abraham's, oh, the gods, they all got in a fight with each other. They did it to themselves.
That's great.
And to us, what do you mean they did it to themselves? I asked you to watch the shop for me. And Abraham's, what, you think I could have done this? I'm just immortal. These are the gods. And the guy's, no, like, you did it. And he's, aha. So then they can't be that powerful if they're so fragile that I could shatter them. And so it's, I guess for me, following the Abrahamic lineage, if we go with your interpretation, it feels like the fragility of the gods, that they have the same drives as us, does lead to a question of what isn't fragile? What isn't just at the whim of some drive coming upon you? I feel like it has to stop somewhere. So it almost leads away from myth to philosophy, just that kind of question. But lest we float around an abstraction on that question, I think what's very interesting to the point you mentioned is this idea that the discovery of oneself as having an integrity corresponds to a certain metaphysics. So in order for me or Genevieve or Cyrus to say, I am Zohar, I am Genevieve, I am Cyrus, as opposed to just stuff is happening to me. Oh my God, the gods are punishing me with anger. Now it's boredom. Now it's lust. My goodness, like I'm just moving from God to God. All things are full of gods. It's like you almost need monotheism, philosophical monotheism at any rate, to underwrite the discovery of the self as having integrity. Otherwise, you basically have psychological polytheism, which is schizophrenia.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I'm not weighing in on the truth content of it. I think we could bracket the question of what's really the case and just focus on what needs to be experientially the case for us to function. And it feels there's a reason why we've probably moved away from this idea of being possessed for the most part to having a more stable view of the self, even though our language still carries these ancient traces. And we talk about falling in love or being inspired, suggesting that maybe we can't do without a little bit of mania, but maybe we don't want mania to be our mental model for what the self is. It's more of a little experience you throw in on top rather than constitutive.
I have two ways of reaching a, let's say, a self-recognition, no? That one is one, that I am that I am, no? And I think it's the monist one, which is the philosophical one, where I think which you're pointing to, is that there has to be something that underlies the polytheism, no? And you can call it monotheism, but if you look at, let's say, the ancient Vedic religion or Hinduism, it's really a form of monism, because you have all of the gods, but there is Brahman. There's Brahma, which is one, but then there's Brahman, no? Which is the one that observes, the seer, not the seen. That's one way, and you need philosophy for that. The other one, which is a Nietzschean one, I would say, is that when you have a multiplicity of gods and they're all always in conflict, no? One god trumps over all of the other gods. And there's a famous aphorism by Nietzsche that goes something like, when one god thought he was the only god, all of the other gods died of laughter. They died. It's a comedy. But there you have one god, no? Or let's say, to bring it back to the psychology, it's you have one drive. And like what Nietzsche likes to say is that drive for us is guilt. It's the triumphant drive.
Why does he say that?
Well, Jesus. Zohar is going to murder me here, but...
Why am I going to murder you? You're feeling guilty, Nico?
No, I'm being overly simplistic, but the idea being that that guilt is... There is, in Nietzsche at least, there is almost an equivalence between consciousness and guilt. That you don't get consciousness without guilt, or self-consciousness for that matter. Yeah, this we can talk hours about this, but what do you think, Jen?
Yeah, I was going to ask Genevieve, what do you think of either about what they say or about the quote originally, all things are full of gods? Because I interpreted it a little bit differently, but I'm curious.
I took less of a academic perspective from it and more from just the principle that if we're all one in essence, and that we're in essence just fractals of the same source, then yes, all things are full of gods. If we are source, and I'm using different words other than gods, because I don't think, you know, source was used then. The way that I interpret God today, or my personal perspective, is that it is source, what we consider God. And there are multiple facets, multiple, I guess, representations or expressions, and that everything that is in existence is some vibration. It's either a light or it's a wave of that expression. And whether that's in something like an element like wind, or if it's in something, I say my earpods, or a human being or an animal, it's all different expressions of source. So I take it quite literally. Yes, all things are full of gods, aka source.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the emphasis in that interpretation is on the word full, rather than gods. Don't get hung up on the quantity. Focus rather on the saturation. So there is a divinity that saturates everything. Wallace Stevens says, God is in me or else it's not at all. For me personally, I related to it a little bit more through the emphasis on gods rather than full of, in the context of Thales. But he wrote, what we have of the pre-Socratic philosophers are fragments, so they're ripe for interpretation of all kinds. So what is a god? That's what Nico asked. And Genevieve suggested that a god is source. A god is a kind of source of life, a source of blessing, an energy. That's maybe a way of thinking about a god almost like intrinsically. You can also think about a god relationally, like a god is that which we esteem or that which we worship. And the question is, why do we esteem or worship it? And one answer might be because it is more powerful than us. And worship is a response to our own powerlessness, but a certain fear that we have about what could happen to us in the face of being powerless. And in many ancient languages, both Hebrew and Greek, actually, the word for fear and the word for awe are deeply interconnected. In Hebrew, the word nora means something which is awesome. It also means something which is terrifying. In ancient Greek, the word deinos means marvelous in a positive sense of like spectacular. It also means marvelous in the negative sense of, wow, this is horrifying. In the Sophocles' Oedipus, a famous line that inspired Shakespeare is, deinos is man and deinos are his works, which leads to the line in Hamlet, what a piece of work is man. That's a piece of work. And you can see it as both a compliment as well as a source of angst. All things are full of gods, I think, suggests all things are full of not just sources of energy or sources of inspiration, but full of power and powers that are putting us in a position of subordination and evoking a response that comes attached to feeling powerless as a result. Maybe that powerlessness leads us to want to become powerful in turn. Maybe it leads to a sense of surrender. Maybe we try to appease it, but we can't escape the fact that there's power in the world and that this power is a source of both empowerment as well as disempowerment. So that's the psychological angle. And then the substantial dimension, why is it gods and not God? So I think that this is an interesting point on organizational theory, which is the best way to explain it is not by thinking metaphysically, but by thinking about a company. Who is the God in a company? Is the God the CEO? Maybe, but then there's the board of directors. And perhaps the God is your manager, but then your manager has a manager. Or perhaps the God is the customer, because if the customer decides no longer to buy your products and services, you're going to go out of business. Or maybe it's the lender who's going to come collect on their loan. Or it's the shareholders who are going to want to sell off their shares in your company, even though it's a perfectly good company, and create a panic. There's so many factors that put you in a position of subordination, despite the fact that you have apparent power. Nobody actually runs the organization, because in order to be an organization, you need to give up power in order to succeed as a team, in order to scale. And so power is shared and it's networked. And that means that in any given context, you are both a god of your domain, as well as in a position where you have to come to the altar of someone else and ask them to help. Even if you're the founder, even if you're the CEO, even if you own 100% of the company, but you simply want people to get along with you. So you have to be in the position of the subordinate. And I think that what Thales is suggesting, all things are full of gods, is that all things are full of power struggles, including for the gods themselves, who in one context might have all the power, but in another context actually are in a position of need. And I'll just close out this interpretation with a sort of nod to Hegel. I think Nietzsche was focused in a way on power difference, and specifically the experience of the disempowered and how they created a sense of revenge in their own minds to compensate themselves for the sense of everyday disempowerment. And he called that ressentiment. But I think Hegel captures the experience not of the disempowered, but rather of everybody. It's more universal, which is that in any given relationship, there's going to be tension, even between people that are of the same status. And this tension is unavoidable. And in contrast to Nietzsche, who says that in your interpretation, Nico, guilt is the driver of self-consciousness, I think that Hegel would say the driver of self-consciousness is the struggle for recognition. So not my guilt at having failed before somebody, but just my need for another person to collaborate with me. And the fact that in order for me to get them to exchange energy with me, I'm going to need to give up something for myself in order to enable that relationship. And so this sense of compromise leads to a psychological instability, because I never know if I'm on top or I'm on bottom, so to say. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's part of it. That's part of the relationship, is that opacity. If it was totally clear where you stood in the relationship, then it wouldn't be an equal relationship. And then you wouldn't have self-consciousness. You actually need equality, in contrast to in the liberal society, John Stuart Mill and the British conception of the individual. Their equality is we all have equal rights, inform the American tradition. In Hegel and the Germanic tradition, equality actually means we all equally need each other. We're all equally vulnerable in relationship to one another. And we're all equally insecure, because neither of us knows if we're the boss or we're the report asking the boss for help. And in fact, we're both. And in Hegel's conception of a good society, every citizen relates to every other citizen as simultaneously his superior and his inferior. And it's the combination of the two that creates equality, rather than just this neutral relationship of we're all equal. No, we're all equal means we're both each other's bosses and each other's inferiors, if you will. So that's where I think of Thales. I think he's basically talking about power struggle is at the heart of everything.
It's
crazy. You don't get to be a god unless someone else is your god. As Bob Dylan says, you got to serve someone. So even the gods have gods.
It's crazy that with such a short quote, you can have so many different interpretations, because I also had a slightly different one than, I'd say it's closest to Genevieve, in that I looked at it as interpreting gods as personalities, like just saying that they're alive, because in the Greek tradition, the gods are, and in a lot of polytheism, they're myriad. And especially in Greek mythology, they're very human, you know, they're very complex characters. So I just took it to say that all things are alive. All things are more than what they seem. All things have a character to them that's beyond the tangible. Could say the rock isn't, it's just a rock. But if all things are full of gods, no, this rock is, it's been, you just can extemporate on the rock. You say this thing's been here for who knows how long, how many feet have trodden upon it. It's sturdy, it's smooth. You can endlessly observe the rock for its qualities. And then the same with the tree or the stream. Clearly, we all had different interpretations of it, which is amazing.
Yeah,
why does he use the word gods? Because he could express all of those points about vitality, for example, without using the word God. And in Greek, the word theos, from which we get theology, I always thought, and this could be, I could be making this etymology up, but in English, we have the word the, T-H-E, the definite article. And people look at the word theology and they see it as T-H-E-O and then logi, right? So the logic or the study of the theos of God, that's what theology means. But you could also hyphenate it as theology, the ology, just like we have biology, the ology of the, which means it's not the study of God, it's the study of the definite article. God is just a placeholder for the definite article. There's a relationship between theos and T-H-E, the, because the suggests that which is overarching. It's, if I say the rock versus a rock, the rock is all rocks,
right?
Whereas a rock is just one of a bunch of them. But the thing that makes the rock is the same philosophical principle that makes God, the sense of being the overarching power relative to other things. Then what's interesting in polytheism is that there are many such deities. So although you can say the rock relative to a rock, you can't say the God because there's lots of them.
It's the definite of the indefinite, right?
Exactly.
If we're talking about articles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
exactly. But I think that's what leads to the one interpretation of monotheism is an attempt to basically say it doesn't really, like, how is it possible that you can have all of these things which are claiming to be the thing, but then relative to one another, they're just a thing. They're just any old thing. One of them has to be the thing of things, the definite article to end all definite articles. And so that's how you get, in my view, like you get Zeus, the biggest god in the pantheon, so he owns the other gods. But then even that, it's too anthropomorphic, because when you look at Zeus's personality, he's what actually makes him any different than just a human being. He's just as pathetic as the next guy. That leads any skeptic to basically say, okay, fine, you know what's really being a god? Not being an entity at all, not having an emotion at all, rather being the source of life or the first principle of creation or something that's much more abstract. And then that's where we get to philosophical monotheism, which is what you get with Aristotle, or you get mysticism, which is almost a move in the opposite direction, which is like to turn God into something so banal that you destroy it, which is why Franz Rosenzweig in the 20th century, German Jewish philosopher, he's a mysticism and atheism shake hands. and those with who are the, following this.
With Spinoza on the side.
Yeah, Spinoza is a pantheist as well as, according to some interpretations, an atheist. And so he would be a great example of someone who's saying God is everything. And thus, in so saying it, he basically, it's, if God is the glass of water and God is my fingernail and God is the feeling of anger, then there's nothing special about God anymore. It becomes a kind of, in effect, atheism. And so then the only difference between, let's say, the mystic and the atheist becomes, goes back to my question of how should we respond to the God? And it focuses on the psychological response rather than the philosophical view. So the philosophical view is just what is true. What is true is there a God in all things. The psychological view is, okay, how should we respond to that? Should we respond in panic, in jubilation, or in equanimity? And that's where maybe a mystic has a view of we should respond with a sense of joy or with a sense of deep feeling. And an atheist is a bit more on of the view of like, all right, now that we checked that one off the list, let's focus on something tangible. Let's focus on something that matters. Like, God is not that interesting of a topic, but it's, they almost agree on the first principles. They just disagree on the attitude you should take to them. So maybe it almost becomes a matter of style. And there have been mystics in every generation, right? Going back thousands of years. And of course, the meaning of mysticism has changed a lot, and it's culturally various. But there seems to be a reason why in the modern age, in our age, a lot of people are attracted to mysticism. And a cynical interpretation of why we see that people like mysticism today is basically because it allows you to say that all things are full of gods in a socially polite company and not sound crazy. Because what you're really saying is, since everything is enchanted, nothing is enchanted. And so it's perfectly of a piece with secularism. But if you start like saying, like, all things are full of gods and the gods are telling me to do all kinds of crazy things. Like, I talk to the gods daily and they're like, yeah, you should get on the subway, get off at this stop and go talk to the seventh stranger that you meet. And then people give you a raised eyebrow. But as long as it's like, oh, I'm feeling so connected to the universe. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, because it's shallow, doesn't intrude.
Zohar, I want to go to one of your principles that you stated, and that everything has, more or less, did you say that everything has a power dynamic, in essence?
Yes.
I do agree with your statement that everything does have a relational tension, actually. That's but I think in nature, it's talking about power is more anthropocentric. And that I don't think that in nature that there's necessarily power struggles, but tension, yes. Whether the stream is going up or down from gravity, right? That's just tension. That's not power. Power, I think, is very humanistic. And I'm not going to take an originalist perspective because I haven't read Thales, so I won't pretend. I'm not going
to. There's nothing to read, though. But there's nothing left.
That's the whole point. I'm not going to do the whole contextual thing about, okay, he was probably speaking from this pantheistic perspective. But to me, thereby, I don't believe that. I don't think that is an accurate premise. That wouldn't be my premise. And I also think nature in and of itself is actually trying to go back to equilibrium, right? That's where we're trying to get to, right? Nature's always calibrating itself to go get back into a state whereby there isn't such necessary tension. To me, when so I wouldn't even base it on power. There's something else to me that's not about relational dynamics. But in fact, if I'm going to use your premise around power, not based on dynamics, but actually, to your point about Zeus, what makes him different from a mortal is actually because he does have power. And it's not relational. It's that he has what we call power, as in what's his superpower, right? And I think everything in life has a superpower. It has a quality that makes it like something quite unique. And to me, this is what I think God's is actually uniqueness. Not special, but uniqueness. Zeus was the god of lightning and thunder. versus Hera or Hestia, right? Like they all had different things. And one was for the underworld, Hades, right? Even down to the specific kinds of qualities or fairies, or like, why was this particular fruit more important than another? I think because of uniqueness, and that if I replace the word of God, all things are full of uniqueness. And I could agree to that statement. That is.
Yeah. That's what I meant by character.
Yeah.
Well,
I like that. Singularity. All things are singular. I think it's worth asking why certain cultures esteem certain sets of singularities above others. For example, why is Zeus is unique, Hera is unique, Hestia is unique, but they're all in the pantheon, and then a bunch of other people or entities that are also unique are not, or they don't get the same level of status. So I agree, like the word God has this sort of ambiguity to it, because on the one hand, everything is a God, everything is unique. On the other hand, we associate God with having a certain status and hierarchy. So Zeus is unique, but we're not worshiping him because he's unique. We're worshiping him for the specific superpower that he has. And if he didn't have that superpower, he wouldn't be Zeus. There's a rabbi, Shai Held, he has a line that I love. Probably, depending on your context, it has the risk of being offensive, but I think it's charming for its offensiveness. He says, Zeus loves women. The God of Israel loves widows, strangers, and orphans. And obviously, the way in which these two gods love is different. So that's part of the funniness of the line, much like in Groucho Marx, he says, time flies like an arrow, but fruit flies like a banana. In many cultures and languages, there's different words for love, or different meanings of love implied in the same word. And Zeus might have the superpower, but he's quite driven by just like banal male lust in a way it's very bizarre. Given that he's supposed to be so powerful, in other cultures, you think of a god as having tremendous self-control. There are stories of Gandhi, who obviously was not a god, but he would put himself to the test where he could go in front of all kinds of temptations and not partake of it, and that was the way that he demonstrated his power. Like, I'm hungry, but I'm not going to eat the food. Zeus does not display that at all. Anyways, just a thought. I think it's interesting to think of the God of Israel's superpower as a particular fondness for the vulnerable, like specifically a desire to help, right? And to be in solidarity with those who have been discarded by society. But in the pagan context, at least the Greek pagan one that Thales is writing in, you don't have that view of any of the gods, that like their superpower is empathy for the downtrodden, interestingly enough. And I think it proves my point, but doesn't disprove yours, which is, it does all come back to power, because the ultimate flex is the ability to not have to show how powerful you are. And Zeus is like the guy who's driving a Ferrari, and we're all like, okay, what are you compensating for? And the God of Israel is so powerful that he doesn't need to go around saying, look at me, I'm so powerful. Yes, you find that in Exodus. But once that has been resolved, God's like doing miracles in secret and like visiting people in their quiet moments of despondency and comforting them. And it's like, God doesn't need the credit for that. You know what I mean? God's power.
Can I say something? Because I have a few comments, but just one, which is a nod to what you're saying. And the question would be to say, like 20 minutes ago, you said, who is the most powerful person in the company, right? And my answer to that would be to say the person who's the most feared. And to this point, fear of what you cannot see is much greater than what you can see. So fear of the invisible is the highest fear.
Not to be taken literally.
So Machiavelli agrees with you that obviously it's better to rule from fear than from love. Other traditions think the opposite, that fear, like the Jewish tradition, Maimonides, thinks that if you obey out of fear, so your obedience is conditional. Whereas if you obey out of love, then it's unconditional. So who's more powerful? The person that the moment that they don't have the ability to coerce or enforce, no one will follow them, or the one who's just super inspiring and awakens a sense of intrinsic motivation?
I would say my point was going more towards the idea of God being hidden.
Yes. Okay, nice.
That's what I mean. And this ties very well with, Jeremy Bentham, the Panopticon, whatever we have going on today, which is self-control is achieved. The self-control of the subject. You don't have to rule over a person. They can control themselves only if they cannot see who's looking, but they know that someone is looking. In fact, like when Jeremy Bentham wrote his stuff on the Panopticon, he talks about the... Do you guys know what a panopticon is, by the way? The cameras, the security camera that has a half
spheroid.
The black dome, you cannot see where the camera is pointing. There's a camera, but you don't see where it's pointing. So, in a sense, there's an ambiguity to see to understand if you're being seen or not, but the camera is still there, which produces or affects a sort of behavior where you assume the role of the one who is
under surveillance.
Take a step back and just explain that. So Jeremy Bentham was a utilitarian in the 19th century who was part of the prison reform movement. Like now we would probably look at his reforms and say that he was not on the side of reform, but was on the side of cruelty or something like this. But nonetheless, compared, how did people treat wrongdoers 500 years before Bentham? They publicly tortured them. So this is the context in which we need to appreciate what he was doing, which was basically say the goal of prison, the goal of punishment should be rehabilitation rather than punishment. And it's a social good to understand the science of how you respond to wrongdoing, as opposed to just saying they did the terrible thing, so let's do a terrible thing in response. And so core to his reform was the construction of a panopticon, which was a security tower. And the core point that Nico is getting at is that the security tower doesn't need somebody in it looking at you at all times, because the goal of the tower is not for the person watching to know what's going on, but for the person being watched to feel that they're being watched at all times so that they can internalize this judgmental gaze and make it their own. And then they go back to society, and the next time they feel like murdering or robbing, they've absorbed the gaze of the other looking at them, and they feel it as their own gaze, and they judge themselves, and they operate like a moral person, even if they're not.
So my point was that like the master signifier, the G-O-D, no, the big one, necessarily has to be invisible. It has to be unseen. It has to be hidden. And not that it's a bad thing, but when I encountered Bentham for the first time, like it was a revelation, because it's like this guy is getting stuff from theology and applying it to punishment and discipline and surveillance, which is crazy.
But don't you think you have to distinguish between two kinds of invisible things that genuinely we're not aware of and things which we are aware of as invisible?
Right.
In other words...
Of course, yes. Yeah.
If I'm in a room and I'm not thinking this room is full of gods, then are the gods there? And what is the effect of Thales saying this statement? Like, is he unmasking the gods and demystifying them? Or is he revealing them and actually calling us to a certain higher state of consciousness where you could walk around and not realize that there's a god in this room? Like Jacob says after he wakes up from a dream, God was in this place and I didn't know it. So is the philosopher here bringing us to a greater God consciousness by saying, pay attention, folks, God is right here? Or is he almost like cutting God down to size by saying, God's right here, so stop looking at the mountain. It's not a big deal. God, there's a difference between we talked about this in our thing on valor and arms, costumes, right? You need to simulate godliness. You need a little bit of mystique. It's going to sound heretical, but God is a costume. There's a certain cosplay where you have to play at God by finding the right balance between being interesting enough to capture attention, but not so legible that people are just like, oh yeah, I get it. And if God is purely invisible, then God doesn't have mystique. If God is purely visible, then there's no promise of revelation. So you've got to show enough of God's skin to awaken the imagination to say, maybe I'd like to see a little bit more God.
Right.
But never do the full reveal, because then it's like there's no wow effect to come.
I don't know if this, I think this story is from Pseudo-Dionysus, who was a second generation Neoplatonist philosopher from a late antiquity. But he was a Christian, after all, or he was a convert Christian. And I don't know if the story is adjudicated to him or to St. Paul, but I think it's him because he's earlier. St. Paul is earlier, right? Zohar, do you know?
St. Paul versus who was the other one?
Pseudo-Dionysus, the Areopagus, or Pseudo-Dionysus.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's St. Paul. And that's so like in late antiquity, they would display the gods in a pantheon, or let's say in a, what was called back then theology, was not purely, let's say, the study of Theo, but also the theater of the gods. So you would have all of the gods lined up in a stage. And they would always leave an empty spot for the god to come, because it was all, I would say that most of polytheism, well, like polytheistic religions, were what's called fractured theologies, which means that the pantheon was not closed. They would incorporate new gods historically and subsequently. So I think when the story goes that St. Paul sees the empty spot for the god to come, and that's where the concept is rounded, whereas this god is unseen in a sense. No? And a lot of that is also can be seen like in the cult of Dionysus in classical Greece or Attic Greece, because Dionysus was a god that was a foreigner. It was a god that came from the east. So he was also Dionysus is the god of the vine and the god of wine and debauchery and blah, blah, blah. But the mask, this is a Nietzschean thing again, but like the mask that they would use for the theater, for Dionysus, was really Apollo. There is no actual representation of Dionysus unless it's to another god. Hence drunkenness, and we go back to the drives thing here. But my point being that it seems that the unseen, when it's codified as such, as unseen, holds a power beyond what's visible, no? And again, I'm not like talking about the company in question here, but what is invisible holds a higher power. There's a famous phrase by Mallarmé, the French poet, that goes something like, unmanifest power is stronger than manifest power.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Potential.
There's a great article, which I recommend to listeners, called Stalin's Blue Pencil. Apparently, there was a time in the 20th century where people edited with blue pencils, because when they did the facsimile of the edited version, the blue wouldn't show up. So it was like a way to do edits without the editing being seen. It's a good metaphor for this non-manifest power. Basically, it becomes a parable for the role of the editor in general, which is that the editor, not the author, is the most powerful. The author, you see their name, they get all the glory. It says on the byline, written by Nico Sarian. But in fact, it's the editor of the meditations.
yes.
You know, which prompts are disallowed, et cetera. How are the prompts sculpted? Now, I'm just making a joke there. But in any case, why is it called Stalin's Blue Pencil? Stalin was an editor. He was an editor of history books. He commissioned histories of Russia to be written, and he vehemently, this is something I was so fascinated to learn, he vehemently edited. Like, he's probably one of the most aggressive editors you've ever met. He took 1,000-page tomes and cut them down to 100 pages. And the author of the article, it's been a year since I read it, was trying to make a link between Stalin, not just the unmanifest aspect of his power, but the purging and the violence that he did to his society and his editorial prowess, that basically like would purge lines from history, but they're all of a cluster with one another. So it's like almost like the power of removal, the power of subtraction is harder to see than the power of addition. It's the god you don't see who's editing, as opposed to the god you do see who's authoring. It's clustered all together.
Actually, once I read an interpretation of the sacrifice of the Pesach lamb it's in Leviticus, not Deuteronomy. I always get that confused, no? As the interpretation went like, I think this is Derrida, but like what he says is that they take the lamb away, they kill the lamb, not for eating, but just to take it away to show you that you cannot have it. So as a gesture, if you will, of subtraction.
Yeah.
I got to say something on that.
Yeah. Because
say something.
Rabbi in the room.
Close this out.
So on the Passover table to this day, every Passover, we have a shank bone in the middle of the table on the Seder plate. And the shank bone represents, it is a sign of the Paschal lamb offering. However, you're not allowed to eat a sacrifice outside of the temple. And the temple doesn't exist. It hasn't existed for thousands of years. So you have a reminder of a sacrifice that you're not allowed to do or not able to do. And you're not even supposed to point at the shank bone. And the reason is, this is for Nico, the reason you're not allowed to point at the shank bone is lest someone looking at you pointing at it think it's the actual Paschal lamb. So it's there to represent the Paschal lamb, but at the same time, you can't say that it is, because if you do, then you might lead someone to think that it isn't a representation, but is the thing itself. So it's a kind of koanic or Zen riff on the line, the finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. The shank bone that represents the Paschal offering, which we weren't allowed to eat and obligated to eat, is not the true Paschal offering. So maybe the God that can be revealed is not the God that is full, that is in the fullness of things.
It's so fascinating to me. Guys, thanks for joining us. Nico, Zohar, Jen, thank you guys. Have a great day, everybody.